Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're going through the Madison's notes on the convention, and we're going through actually Madison's comments regarding the Patterson plan and regarding, or at least the New Jersey plan, and the plan that Hamilton provided. And so we're kind of going through this picking apart in the Constitutional Convention how Madison's basically pointing to the Patterson plan and saying it's why would we consider another inept approach? Now, I'm not sure understanding the character of men, which transcends all time, because men, people, humans, I should say, have pride in what they're doing, their associations and so forth. I mean, pride is a huge problem. And so the way Madison was picking at this, there's no doubt in my mind it was probably ruffling the feathers of Mr. Patterson and those who actually wanted to, wanted to see the Union stay stuck in this bad state of governing. Now, I don't think that that was what they were saying in their mind. They were afraid of making some changes. And so I think in some ways they were making excuses for, you know, these wanderings of actually dealing with the exigencies of the Union. Might I reemphasize that every state commissioned their delegates in this convention to take the liberty and latitude necessary to deal with the exigencies of the Union. And yet we keep on hearing a couple of the naysayers, anti-federalists, saying, I don't know, this may be, you know, violent. This is not within our commissions. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Lansing of New York, a anti-federalist, is the one that's brought it up a few times now, now that we've actually been talking about this. So my point is, folks, that I understand, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I do understand the nature that we tend to, you know, get our feelings hurt when we get rejected. We tend to fail to, you know, ascend to the greater cause naturally. I mean, there's got to be a good reason. And I believe that these men were truly being, I'll say, guided and directed to kind of step beyond, because these, most all of these men, even though they may not have signed, I mean, there were a certain percentage of men that didn't sign this document, the Constitution, but they worked, they didn't quit. And many of them, like Mason, kept on, you know, animating and saying, we got to get these things in here. We've got to do that. We need a Bill of Rights. We need to change this. And getting into the ratification debates, which is one of the reasons why these anti-federalists became automatic shoo-ins to the ratification debates, because the state cabal wanted to make sure these guys were in there. And so anyway, let me get into what we were going to say. But before I do, there's one more thing. Do not forget, this coming Monday, the 11th of March, I will begin airing only a the series that I provided earlier. Only a constitutional president can make a difference. If you're looking for a difference, a change in direction, then you need to really be looking for a constitutional president, somebody that actually can articulate the powers that exist. Imagine a president removing Supreme Court justices from the bench for violating their oath by trying to reinterpret or create law. It doesn't matter if they've been getting away with it, and they've been getting away with it for 200 years. It's a violation. They don't have that authority. The Constitution won't permit it. The only way law can be created is by the legislature. And the only way that can change is through an amendment from 3/4 of the states. We have these protections under this document. We only have to enforce it. We have been bamboozled. The Constitution is not the problem. Okay? The 14th Amendment is definitely not the problem. And I'm here to tell you, though I don't like the 16th and the 17th Amendments, they're not the problem. We are the boogeyman. These amendments that have been passed are not obviously the original 13th Amendment was a boogeyman to the progressives because they made sure they got rid of that. Or not constitutionally, but they scrubbed it out and like we're none the wiser. And yet we have all of the evidence today that it is a legitimate amendment, just like the First Amendment is a legitimate amendment. But they're not going to give it to us because it would force Congress to actually, you know, be reduced, or their representation be reduced to 50,000 people. Imagine that. The Electoral College is actually supposed to be at 50,000. And our representation is supposed to be at 50,000. Nobody wants to deal with these things. But we have to start dealing with these things. It's about time we put our adult britches on and started doing our job. Anyway, Madison. This is Madison going through, and he's at point number 7 regarding Mr. Patterson's plan. He says, he begged the smaller states, which were much more attached to Mr. Patterson's plan, to consider the situation in which it would leave them. In the first place, they would continue to bear the whole expense of maintaining their delegates in Congress. It ought not to be said that if they were willing to bear this burden, no others had a right to complain. As far as it has led the small states to forbear keeping up representation by which the public business was delayed, it was evidently a matter of common concern. An examination of the minutes of Congress would satisfy everyone that the public business has been frequently delayed by this cause, and that the states most frequently unrepresented in Congress were not the larger states. He reminded the convention of another consequence of leaving a small state the burden of maintaining a representation in Congress. During a considerable period of the war, one of the representatives of Delaware, in whom alone, before the signing of the Confederation and the entire vote of the state, and after that event, one half of its vote frequently resided, was a citizen and resident of Pennsylvania, and held an office in his own state, incompatible with an appointment from it to Congress. During another period, the same state was represented by 3 delegates, 2 of whom were citizens of Pennsylvania, and the 3rd a citizen of New Jersey. These expedients must have been intended to avoid the burden of supporting delegates from their own state. But whatever might have been the cause, was not in effect the vote of the state doubled and an influence of another increased by it? In the second place, the coercion on one with the efficacy of the plan depends can never be exerted but on themselves. The larger states will be impregnable and the smaller only can feel the vengeance of it. He illustrated the position by the history of the Amphictyonic Confederates and the ban of the German Empire. It was a cobweb, which could entangle the weak, but would be the sport of the strong. I'm sorry, these acronyms are actually abbreviations. Anyway, now we're going into point 8. He begged them to consider the situation, which they would remain in their case, their pretentious adherence to an inadmissible plan should prevent the adoption of any plan. The contemplation of such an event was painful, but it would be prudent to submit to the tasks of examining it at distance. That means of escaping, it might be more readily embraced. Let the union of the states be dissolved, and one of two consequences must happen. Either the states must remain individually independent and sovereign, or two or more confederacies must be formed among them. In the first event, would the small states be more secure against the ambition and power of the larger neighbors than they would be under a general government pervading with an equal energy every part of the empire and have an equal interest in protecting every part against every other part? In the second, can the smaller expect that their larger neighbors would confederate with them on the principle of present confederacy, which gives each member an equal suffrage, or that they would exact less, sever concessions from the major states than are proposed in the scheme of Mr. Randolph? Now, got to remember, this is Madison's plan. He just kind of dropped the little bomb on. So he's making, I think, a great ending point here, because he 8 was the last one. Then he goes into this, you know, kind of like winding us down this next direction. But bottom line, you know, when he looks at it, and what would have happened? What would have happened had the states actually gone independent and they broke the Confederation? What actually started happening, and this actually happened under the Constitution, that the Northeastern states actually started creating, and they actually had some conventions where they were talking about seceding, where they were talking about maybe an Article 5 convention. They were not happy. And when Jefferson kind of took over, because they were the Anglophile states, and they didn't like the Francophile Jefferson. Now, Jefferson, I don't think, by the time he was elected, was a hardcore Francophile. As a matter of fact, recognizing the turmoil that had actually wreaked havoc on France, you know, I think he had to do some acknowledgement in admitting that, you know, offing everybody's heads wasn't a very good civil revolution. But anyway, when we look at how the other states started breaking up, and what would have ended up happening was we just never would have become galvanized and been able to, I mean, look at what we've been able to do under the Constitution. Had we actually gotten rid of slavery the way we were supposed to, the way we intended, the way it was promised going into the Revolution, that we would no longer have slavery. Remember, the Articles of Association actually committed the states to actually stop these practices. So when they went into the Articles of Confederation, there was a different set of politicians that went in there. Are you kidding me? No ideologues. It's about business, and we're going to keep slavery. Anyway, let me get back to what Madison was basically saying. So now he's gone through this long list of 1 through 8 of these problems with Mr. Patterson's plan. Now let's take a look at the turn he takes here. The great difficulty lies in the affair of representation, and if this could be adjusted, all others would be surmountable. It was admitted by both the gentlemen from New Jersey, Mr. Beerley and Mr. Patterson, that it would not be just to allow Virginia, which was 16 times as large as Delaware, an equal vote only. Their language was that it would not be safe for Delaware to allow Virginia 6 times as many votes. The expedient proposed by them was that all states should be thrown into one mass and a new partition be made into 13 equal parts. Would such a scheme be practicable? the dissimilarities existing in the rules of property, as well as the manners, habits, and prejudices of the different states, amounted to a prohibition of the attempt. It had been found impossible for the power of one of the most absolute princes in Europe, the King of France, directed by the wisdom of one of his most enlightened and patriotic ministers, Mr. Necker, that had at any age has produced to equalize in some points only the different usages and regulations of the different provinces. But admitting a general amalgamation and repartition of the states to be practicable, and the danger apprehended by the smaller states from a proportional representation to be real, would not a particular voluntary coalition of these of their neighbors be less inconvenient to the whole community and equally effectual for their own safety? If New Jersey or Delaware conceived that an advantage would accrue to them from an equalization of the states, in which case they would necessarily form a junction with their neighbors, why might not this end be attained by leaving them at the liberty by the Constitution to form such a junction whenever they please? And why should they wish to be obtruded or obtrude a like arrangement on all the states when it was, to say the least, extremely difficult, would be obnoxious to many states, and when neither the inconveniency nor the benefit of the expedience to themselves would be lessened by confining it to themselves? The prospect of many new states to the westward was another consideration of importance. I'm going to point out that the Articles of Confederation really didn't have a mechanism of bringing new states into the Union, which is one of the reasons why the Northwest Ordinance had passed right after the Constitution was signed and sent out for ratification. It was in October 1787, right after these guys finished doing what they did here. And what ended up happening was this Constitution, before any of those states could come into the Union, this Constitution superseded. Basically, it overcame the Northwest Ordinance. And so you hear people refer to and talk about the Northwest Ordinance as a legitimate law. No. All the laws and everything the Continental Congress had done was, other than the treaties and the financial commitments and those things with other nations, all of the internal laws themselves were done away. And say, oh, no, that was a treaty with the inhabitants of these territories. No, that was treaties with our own people. That was not the same thing. And so the admission of states into the Union came from Congress. And even though in the admission of Indiana, they tried to invoke the Northwest Passage because they had more control over it, this was the nefarious side of the, I'll just say, Congress. By 1816, they started trying to figure ways that they could take advantage of states so they could basically ingratiate themselves with more resources, power, bring in money. These folks in the federal government were already just throwing the Constitution not under the bus completely, but they were taking liberties that would open up doors and portals for, you know, just a complete perversion of the Constitution. And as George Washington stated, when we allow, whether it's by good intent or not, whether we allow the Constitution to be violated or usurped, powers of the states be usurped, these are the instances that every good nation is destroyed. By allowing a little bit at a time, the tolerance. Anyway, Madison goes on and says, if they should come into the Union at all, he's talking about these Western states, they would come in when they contained but few inhabitants. If they should be entitled to vote according to the proportions of inhabitants, all would be right and safe. Let them have an equal vote and a more objectionable minority than might ever give law to the whole. On a question for postponing generally the first proposition of Mr. Patterson's plan, it was agreed to with New Jersey, and New Jersey only being no. In other words, when they said, hey, let's just put, you know, this whole plan, let's just postpone this whole first proposition of Mr. Patterson's plan, the New Jersey plan, let's just put it aside. Everybody voted yes to put it aside. Only New York and New Jersey were the ones that said no. Now, remember, who was New York? Now, New York had three anti-federalists, or I should say three out of the three. You had Hamilton, who probably voted yes for this, but Lansing and I think Livingston was the other one. Both of those guys were very apprehensive to be on the record for going against Clinton. They, you know, they had to mind their P's and Q's, and I think that they were just kind of safely. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind, because Lansing was probably a driving force, because if when you really look, and I'm just going to stop right here, and I'm going to go up, and I'm going to look, and I go, okay, we've seen Lansing speak. I do not see anywhere where Livingston spoke at all. Don't see him at all. And so it's not that he didn't speak. I'm as I go through here, Lansing is obviously jumped out a few times. Nothing. And as a matter of fact, Lansing speaks again later, and he brings up the commission again. And we'll get to that as we go down. Anyway, so the next paragraph, on the other question moved by Mr. King, whether the committee should rise and Mr. Randolph's propositions be re-reported without alteration, which was in fact a question whether Mr. Randolph should be adhered to as preferable to those of Mr. Patterson. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, aye. New York, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, no. Maryland, divided. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, aye. Georgia, aye. In other words, it looks like the ayes had it. Insert here from the printed journal, page 3, or page 13, copy of the resolution of Mr. Randolph as altered in the committee and reported to the House. I'm sorry, it says come, and so you go C-O-M-E, and I go, huh? Committee. So I'm feeling the pain not having Paul here. Anyway, so now it says, state the resolution submitted to the consideration of the House by the Honorable Mr. Randolph as altered, amended, and agreed to in a committee of the whole House. One, resolve that it is the opinion of this committee that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, judiciary, and executive. So why is it the supreme legislative? Is it a supreme judiciary, supreme executive, or just supreme legislative? I don't know. Anyway, resolved, and you've got to remember, back in those days, they did refer to the legislative branch, or your legislators, as the sovereigns. Resolved that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches. So at this point, they're saying, okay, we're going to have these two branches. Three, resolved that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states for the term of 3 years to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for their devotion of their time to public service to be paid out of the national treasury. So this way, the states could not cause problems because they can't fund their representation of the federal government. So now we can kind of see why some of these things were happening. Did you know that in the Continental Congress, they couldn't even afford, so they asked, hey, you guys over there in Pennsylvania, could you fill one of our seats and kind of vote for us, please? Imagine that being on the table today with Congress. Anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. So please stay tuned, and we're going to get back into these resolutions provided by Randolph out of the committee.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's get back. Let's just start, pick it up from the third resolution. Resolve that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states for the term of 3 years to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service to be paid out of the national treasury. Now, keep in mind, they were only to be compensated for their time of service, no retirement, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those particularly belonging to the functions of the first branch, like a committeeman, or I should say, a chair of a committee, during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration. In other words, you couldn't go get a job somewhere else once you were no longer in office for 1 year. Resolved that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the individual legislatures to be at the age of 35 at least. So interestingly enough, they didn't mention the 25 years age for Congress yet. But you can start to see some of these things are forming that are lining up with the Constitution. That these men will be 35 years of age, that they will be selected or chosen by the state legislatures to hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their independency, namely 7 years, to receive fixed stipends, by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by any particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those particularly belonging to the functions of the second branch during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration. In other words, once they get out of office. Resolved, this is five, resolved that each branch ought to possess the right of originating acts. Six, resolved that the national legislature ought to be empowered to enjoy the legislative rights vested in Congress by the Confederation and moreover to legislate in all cases which the separate states are incompetent. Now, see, you know that's not going to fly, but this is just the starting, right? So they had to actually specify. This is why they started enumerating and getting more and more specific, because there was a lot of distrust here. You know, we wanted to make sure that nothing was going to create advantages against this big, small states, east, west, north, south. Anyway, incompetent, or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation. To the negative, all powers passed by the several states, contravening in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of the Union, or any treaties subsisting under the authority of the Union. Seven, resolve that the right of suffrage in the first branch of the national legislature ought not be according to the rule established in the Articles of Confederation, but according to some equitable ratio of representation, namely, in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants, now say white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age. Now, so I'm pointing this out because the paradigm back then, even under the Confederation, was white and free citizens. They weren't the same. In other words, they weren't exclusive. They were inclusive when it came to free citizens, any and all free citizens, black or what have you. This goes back to my mentioning yesterday, the the self-proclaimed professor of organic law, who basically said that this nation was created by, for, and only to be enjoyed by whites. And folks, this I'm going to get into this Friday, and I'm really going to dissect this for you because I want you to understand the danger of where these doors, the hinges of these doors meet on the two sides of the space that these doors divide. Those who actually, you know, are hanging outside the general assemblies or the sovereign states and those who get you through those doors. The paradigm is based on falsehoods. It is all contrived and it is all based on unauthorized powers. All these boogeymen that they're creating to convince you to surrender your citizenship is all based on lies and deceit. The federal government has no authority to do all of the things it's done. It's granted themselves unconstitutionally, in other words, by the color of law, all of these authorities to use capital letters and all this crap. And the way the courts and everything else, they may have doublespeak, and they may even recognize the doublespeak. They may be playing the game because that only validates what they're doing. But to challenge and to say, where did you have the authority to do this, to create that, to change this? And nobody can answer that, and nobody has source documents. I challenge this self-proclaimed professor to provide me documents, source documents, that prove that no black man could vote. As a matter of fact, it wasn't just limited to that. It wasn't just that. It was also stated that it was the law that if it was proven that a black man did vote, that his vote would be nullified. And I go, give me the source documents. You're talking about law. Those laws had to have been written down. There's no doubt in my mind they don't have secret laws, which is what he's implying. He said, well, they're not. And I go, no. The challenge for you is to prove it. I can prove everything that I state and assert. And as a matter of fact, there's plenty of documents out there, unbeknownst to this gentleman, how the state of New York allowed free black men for years and years up until the early 1800s. That's when they started denying them. That's when they started playing the politics as they started heading towards the Missouri Compromise. And then once they created the Missouri Compromise, it kind of galvanized the oppression of blacks in America. There may have still been some instances, but it was getting worse and worse for black freemen. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why Monroe was actually repatriating the freemen from America back to Liberia, to Monrovia. Anyway, let's get back to this. I digress because it brought up a point that just, you know, piqued my interest and something I wanted to share. 7, I'm going to repeat this, resolve that the suffrage in the first branch of the national legislature ought not to be according to the rule established in the Articles of Confederation, but according to some equitable ratio of representation, namely in proportion to the whole number of whites and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes in each state. In other words, see, there were obviously there was these two types of Indians. And the bottom line is, this is because there was, you know, they had to be naturalized. And they created the pattern, the process of naturalization. They didn't say an Indian couldn't be naturalized. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the 14th Amendment, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, all people born here under the jurisdiction of this government are U.S. citizens. Now, that doesn't mean that if, you know, somebody that comes here that is not under that jurisdiction and that child is born here is instantly considered. The jurisdiction of the parent is, you know, what do they call that? It is the predecessor of determining the jurisdiction of the child. In other words, the child inherits that same jurisdiction. A person who's lived here, who was born here and is under the jurisdiction, and their parents were born here under that jurisdiction, and even though they're not citizens, they're citizens now because of the 14th Amendment, which means all Indians and all slaves. That means that all those blacks that were in slavery and all the Indians that were living within the states and under the jurisdiction, in other words, on territories, what have you, because they were under the jurisdiction, folks. And this was one of the problems that some of the, I'll just say, the anti-14th Amendment folks in Congress kind of piped up and said, that's going to make citizens out of these Indians. And they tried to use that as leverage to not ratify or not to pass the 14th Amendment. But remember, the 14th Amendment flied through both houses in one vote. It was done easily, two-thirds in both houses. They wanted to protect these people. As a matter of fact, I don't even think it was that it was really their will and want. I think it was more of the inspiration, because it just galvanizes my paradigm that the divine hand of providence was directly involved in that 14th Amendment, just like he was directly involved in this, the forming of this Constitution. Number 8, resolved that the right of suffrage in the second branch of the national legislature ought to be according to the rule established for the first. 9, resolved that a national executive be instituted to consist of a single person to be chosen by the national legislature. Okay, so again, they're maintaining the Articles of Confederation, where this is a president, not of the states, but an administrative president over this small little government. Not the president that we have today that was chosen by the people. This is chosen by the national legislature. Now, even though the Electoral College, if they can't do the job, it is still done by our representatives, not by the senators. In other words, if you look at the 12th Amendment or that process in Article 2 and the 12th Amendment, it always comes down to our representatives who choose the president. Okay, so anyway, to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of 7 years, with power to carry into execution the national laws to appoint to offices in cases not otherwise provided for, to be ineligible a second time. So they actually had, for this is the only time that they actually had a term limit to make sure that after 7 years, and so this is one of the reasons why it became an automatic, I stepped down after 2 terms, because the paradigm, the sentiments of the people at the time felt that having an executive for 7 years, 8 years, was the max out. I mean, you've got to go, which is why Washington stepped down, Adams was removed, but Jefferson stepped down, Madison stepped down, Monroe stepped down, and so forth. And so anyway, to be ineligible a second time and to be removable on impeachment and conviction of malpractice or neglect of duty. I mean, how many presidents have neglected their duty? This is why I'm running this very special series, Only a Constitutional President Can Make a Difference. They have a duty. They're supposed to be doing very specific things. And the fact is, they're not doing it. So anyway, to receive a fixed stipend by which he may be compensated for the devotion of his time to public service to be paid out of the national treasury. 10. Resolved that the national executive shall have a right to negative any legislative act, which shall not be afterwards passed unless by 2/3 parts of each branch of the national legislature. So the veto power and those types of things were already, you know, they were already starting to surface. Resolved that a national judiciary be established to consist of one supreme tribunal, the judges of which to be appointed by the second branch of the national legislature, in other words, the Senate, to hold their offices during good behavior and receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase, it says increase, but it's no increase or diminution, shall be made so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase, E-N, but it's increase, I, or diminution. 12. Resolve that the national legislature be empowered to appoint inferior tribunals, in other words, district courts. 13. Resolve that the jurisdiction of the national judiciary shall extend to cases which respect the collection of the national revenue, impeachments on national officers, and questions which involve the national peace and harmony. 14. Resolved that provisions ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from voluntary junction of government and territory or otherwise the consent of a number of voices in the national legislature of the whole. Now, see, they limited states being able to be admitted into the union unless they were within, arising in the limits of the United States. That was taken out. That now Congress has the power to admit new states into the union. They can be states from anywhere in the world, folks. Anywhere in the world. However, the stipulations of requirements, language, law, currency, those types of things have to be addressed, and that's one of the reasons why Congress, you know, established, and in some cases, and as a matter of fact, not even in some cases, they actually mandated that you had to have, like the California and some of these areas, actually had to have a certain percentage of English-speaking people. They had to be Christian. They became very guarded over very specific, I'll just say, nuances of our demographics and the uniquenesses. Anyway, 15, resolved that provision ought to be made for the continuance of Congress and their authorities until a given day after the reform of the Articles of Union shall be adopted and for the completion of all their engagements. In other words, all the work that they have in work, let them complete it and be done, and then this new government stands. Resolved that a Republican Constitution and its existing laws ought to be guaranteed to each state by the United States. Resolved. I mean, you're seeing these things as, you know, as this is the birth of why and how these things got in there. Okay. Resolved that the provision ought to be made for the amendment of the Articles of the Union whensoever it shall seem necessary. In other words, the Article 5, they have to have that provision. So they put that in there. And it doesn't say that, oh, this provision should protect certain amendments from happening, because that's actually in Article 5 on top of that. But anyway, number 18, resolved that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers within the several states ought to be bound by oath to support the Articles of the Union. That's right there in Article 6. This is a component to Article 6. Resolved that the amendments which shall be offered by the Confederation by the Convention ought at a proper time after the approbation of Congress to be submitted to an assembly or assemblies of representatives recommended by the several legislatures to be expressly chosen by the people to consider and decide thereon, you know, whether to ratify this government or this new form of government. And then there's a little note of Mr. Randolph's plan, as reported from the committee, the number one proposal that a national government ought to be established and consisting, etc., being taken up in the House. And so they had this little, I guess, debate. Then Mr. Wilson actually stands up and says that he observed that a national government did not mean one that would swallow up state governments, as seemed to be wished by some gentlemen. He was tenacious of the idea of preserving the latter. He thought, contrary to the opinion of Colonel Hamilton, that they might not only subsist on friendly terms with the former. They were absolutely necessary for certain purposes which the former could not reach. All large governments must be subdivided into lesser jurisdictions. As examples, he mentioned Persia, Rome, and in particular the divisions and subdivisions of England by Alfred. Colonel Hamilton then coincided with the proposition as it stood in the report. He had not been understood yesterday. By an abolition of the states, he meant that no boundary could be drawn between the national and state legislatures, that the former must therefore have indefinite authority. The state legislature should have indefinite authority. If it were limited at all, the rivalship of the states would gradually subvert it. Even as corporations, the extent of some of them, as Virginia, Massachusetts, etc., would be formidable as states, he thought that they ought to be abolished, but he admitted the necessity of leaving them subordinate jurisdictions. The examples of Persia and Roman Empire, cited by Mr. Wilson, where he thought in favor of this doctrine, the great powers delegated to the satraps and proconsuls, and I have no idea what he's referring to, I think that's a historical point, having frequently produced revolts and schemes of independence. So there we go. Mr. King, now this is Rufus King, and Mr. Rufus King basically wished, or stood up and said, I wish that everything depended on this proposition, that no objections might be improperly indulged against the phraseology of it. He conceived that the import of the term states, quote, unquote, sovereignty, quote, unquote, national, quote, unquote, federal, quote, unquote, had been often used and applied in the discussions inaccurately and delusively. The states were not sovereign in the sense contended for by some. They did not possess the peculiar features of sovereignty. They could not make war, nor peace, nor alliances, nor treaties. Considering them as political beings, they were dumb, for they could not speak for any sovereign whatever. They were deaf, for if they could not hear any propositions from such sovereign. Now, let me stop right here. This is just showing you, because we have the same problem today. When we talk to people that are caught in this, we are sovereigns, the people are sovereigns. I see this from the anarchists all the time. As a matter of fact, the sovereign citizen movements and these, I'll just call them patriots going amok or awry. We have a system that has distributed sovereignty through from the people to the county, and from the people and county to the states, and from the people, county, and states to the federal. So in other words, the people are involved in each of the three governments because we have representation in each of the governments. And each of the governments have delegated powers that reside with that government and limited government, whatever that is, at each level. The greatest government with the greatest powers is your county government. The government with the least powers, even though they may be the most horrific, like war, that's for very specific reasons. So we live in a governing system where a single sovereign does not exist in our government. I'm not saying that God doesn't exist. I am saying that at this point in time, he hasn't taken his seat on the throne in this world. And at this time, we have distributed sovereignty of our governance from we the people to our counties, and from we the people in the counties to the states, and from we the people, counties, and states to the federal. And as you notice, it's like a snowball. People being at the center, and then the county, and then it wraps up the state, and then it wraps up the federal. And that is very, very tight as far as the further away you get from the people, the more tight the enumerations are, the more limited they are. And that's how it was done, and that's how it still is today. The assumed powers that they can just do anything, and that they've basically convinced everybody, at least way too many people, because there's not enough people challenging them, but they've convinced enough people to give them all of the latitude to do all the terrible things that they're doing. So anyway, so Mr. King is standing up and saying, hey, look here. You know, you guys are kind of mixing up, you know, these apples and oranges as I see what a sovereign is, and that we the people are the sovereign. In other words, Mr. King has not been able to actually look at from a different view how sovereignty is distributed within government at the different levels of government. He believes that if you're going to call this a sovereign, that it's sovereign over all things. You can't be partially sovereign, and that's not true. As a matter of fact, the concept of a limited power of attorney creates and allows somebody to be sovereign over one thing while somebody is still sovereign over all other things. And so, you know, this is why I said that the maturity of contracts, the maturity of the distributions of power and sovereignty, you know, it eluded many. And today, it eludes almost everybody. I mean, folks, I know you get this. And I know there's a few of you may be struggling with this. But I do know this, that outside of this circle, the listeners to this show, there are very few people that understand this. And it's sad. I mean, we live in a world of you know, computing and shared computing, shared processes and so forth. And I mean, this distribution of responsibilities, this distribution of sovereignty shouldn't boggle anybody's minds. But yet we've been dumbed down to simpletons to say, well, you know, I have to buy into everything because I don't live in this government that was formed and ratified. But you do. And you were born into it, and you have to learn. And the idea that somebody has been teaching you this concept that, you know, you have to have full buy-in. There's no government in the world other than an anarchal government, a democratic government that allows you, even in a democracy, you're still mob rule. You don't have any government that can function on the principles that you have to buy into everything, and everybody has to buy into everything. That would destroy you. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.